Hi there. Welcome to another edition of the Social Chemist Podcast. A few years back, I did an episode on QAnon, and after publishing it, I quickly deleted it. I did this because at the time I was trying to produce episodes as quickly as possible to maintain a consistent schedule. However, this came at the cost of producing poor content with information that didn't connect with other resources. So I told myself that I would redo the episode. But as many of you already know, with the constant responsibilities of my master's program, I never had the opportunity to cover QAnon again until now. On today's episode, I'll be speaking to a medical professional about QAnon, what it is, and how mental health professionals should prepare themselves in evaluating believers if they happen to come across them in their practice or work setting. I hope you enjoy today's discussion, as I'm sure you'll learn a whole lot about psychiatric diagnosis. So, let's dive in. Hello, listeners. Welcome to another episode of the Social Chemist Podcast. I'm your host, Nelson, and today we are joined by Dr. Brian Haloida, a board-certified forensic psychiatrist. He is internationally recognized for his experience in violence risk assessment, correctional psychiatric practice, paraphilic disorder evaluation and management, and group beliefs. Dr. Haloida's experience includes working in correctional and inpatient settings, treating severely mentally ill individuals with psychotherapy and psychopharmacology. But on today's episode, he joins me to discuss his 2021 literature review titled QAnon, A Modern Conspiracy Theory, An Assessment of Its Believers, a research article that dives into the origin of the QAnon movement in the U.S. and recommendations for mental health evaluators in assessing QAnon supporters. Dr. Haloida, thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Haloida, I wanted to talk about your motivation in writing this literature review, because in researching you and learning a little bit about your background, I feel like we might have a similar origin story. When I started my master's program at Rutgers, I entered a clinical pathway, and my goal was to work with individuals that had paraphilic disorders, pedophiles. And in doing the research, I learned a lot, but there was a few obstacles in my way. One of them being that the topic of paraphilic disorders can be controversial. There wasn't any professors or supervisors that can train me in working with patients with paraphilic disorders. When it came to finding an internship, there was no agencies around my area. And in some courses, in some instances, I was actually discouraged from writing about the topic because of how stigmatizing it can be, even though I was going to write it from an academic perspective. And so I was a graduate student without any purpose. I was just taking courses and I was like, all right, let's see what happens. But then QAnon came along. And if you follow the QAnon movement, the main villain are pedophiles, are Democratic Hollywood pedophiles. And with my background, I was able to differentiate between what was fact and what was fiction. And it helped me really understand, you know, the conspiracy theory mindset. And from there, I ended up going from a clinical student to more of a research analysis on studying conspiracy theories. And so when it comes to your background and understanding paraphilic disorders, was that a motivation for you to dive into the QAnon movement?
It's funny that you draw the line between the paraphilic disorders work that I do and then my interest in sort of group beliefs, such as conspiracy theories and cult beliefs. I actually had never made that connection. So Very early in my training, I became interested in primarily the forensic evaluation of sexual offenders, which of course includes individuals who suffer from paraphilic disorders, things like pedophilic disorder, sexual sadism disorder, those sorts of things. So that was one of my very early initial forensic interests. And from that, I studied and published widely on topics like bestiality, as well as the treatment of individuals with paraphilic disorders, looking at the different sorts of biological agents that we're able to use to help those individuals. And that took me to where I am today, where a lot of my forensic practice focuses on the evaluation of sexual offenders. Including sexually violent predators. So no, that was always very separate. It's very strange that yes, QAnon and a lot of conspiracy theories over the years have focused on individuals or the idea of groups of pedophiles who are persecuting children in mass quantities. But that was always separate for me. So I have always had an interest in what I term group beliefs. I used to refer to them as atypical group beliefs, but there are many different types of group beliefs, such as conspiracies, that are not atypical and that are widely prevalent, in the general population. So I've published and presented on cults and cult-related beliefs. In my forensic practice, I have evaluated individuals who would probably be referred to as sovereign citizens, which is also sort of a separate type of group belief. And then, as you know, you mentioned, I published on QAnon, sort of the most popular and in vogue conspiracy theory of the last few years, trying to differentiate between these different types of group beliefs, and really, as a forensic psychiatrist, trying to help individuals, whether in the clinical realm or in the forensic realm, to understand these different types of beliefs and to be able to distinguish them from mental illness, which is commonly what we're trying to do in forensic assessment, which is to come up with an accurate diagnosis and understand how an individual's mental illness may affect the legal question that's posed to us. So that's where my interest in these types of group beliefs began. And that's how I've sort of gotten interested in cults and conspiracy theories and sovereign citizens and all of those sorts of things.
When it comes to mental health evaluators, I don't know if you consider social work in that category, but I don't see a lot of what we do associated with conspiracy theories. And so why is it important for, the field of forensic psychiatry to really look into the QAnon movement and understand its supporters?
I think there are many reasons why it's important for individuals practicing both in the clinical setting as well as in the forensic setting to understand all sorts of different types of group beliefs, but especially the current iteration of what that may be. So, recently with the rise of QAnon, which has become relatively mainstream, possibly because of how much it's been published about in the media, certainly has probably helped stoke it a little bit. But yeah, it's important because these are strange beliefs, right? Looking at them from the outside, an individual could certainly view some of the concepts or the ideas in QAnon and other conspiracy theories as potentially being evidence of mental illness, which is a problem because it's not evidence of mental illness strictly. So it's important for people practicing in a clinical setting to be able to distinguish between true delusional thoughts and conspiracy theories or religious beliefs or cult beliefs because it has an impact on your diagnosis, right? So you don't want to be diagnosing somebody who believes in QAnon, whose beliefs are shared with millions of people across the world, you don't want to be diagnosing that person with a psychotic disorder, such as delusional disorder or schizophrenia, because you might recommend treatment which is inappropriate. You don't want to be, as a practicing psychiatrist, you don't want to be putting people who espouse conspiracy theories on antipsychotic medication, because that would be incorrect treatment and improper and potentially lead to side effects and issues and legal repercussions. So clinically, it's important to be able to distinguish, because you want to be able to formulate an accurate diagnosis and an accurate treatment plan that addresses whatever the actual issue is. From a forensic context, forensic psychiatry, forensic psychology, the field of forensic assessment in general, has a very different goal from that of the clinical realm. So in forensic assessment, you are typically given a question by the court or by an attorney that you are asked to answer using your understanding of psychiatric diagnosis. So common examples in the forensic world would be competency to stand trial, or criminal responsibility evaluations. That's also sometimes referred to as sanity evaluations. So competency to stand trial refers to whether or not the individual at the moment in time that you evaluate them is capable of going to court and participating in their defense. Sanity, on the other hand, refers to the person's mental state at the time that they committed whatever they've been accused of. So in both cases, what you're trying to do is assess for some sort of psychiatric diagnosis and to see if the person's current symptoms, in the case of competency, if their current symptoms affect their ability to go to court, and in the case of a sanity evaluation, whether their mental state at the time of the offense was somehow affected by mental illness. So if you're a forensic evaluator, and you encounter somebody who's claiming, oh, well, at the time I did this, I thought there were a group of pedophiles with a group of children in the basement that they were ritualistically abusing. That could sound very delusional. That could sound like a symptom of delusional disorder or schizophrenia. And if you don't recognize that as part of a conspiracy theory that many people believe, then you could diagnose the person with a mental illness, say they were insane at the time that they committed the crime, which would be inappropriate and result in an inappropriate outcome for that individual potentially. So that's a long way of saying that in forensic assessment, it is also important to be able to distinguish between mental illness, conspiracy theories, religious beliefs, sovereign citizen beliefs, so that you know whether or not this person has a mental illness, and what it was that actually contributed to their behavior, either in the past or at the present moment.
From your observation or from your opinion, how, in general, how adequate do you think your field of forensic psychiatry is in differentiating between a mental diagnosis and conspiracy theories? Because when it comes to learning about conspiracy theories, there's just so much. There's so many conspiracy theories. And that's a challenge to learn about, you know, the conspiratorial narratives. And I can only imagine the challenge. And so, in your opinion, where do you see the forensic psychiatry? Is it ill-prepared to address these issues?
Well, what I would say is that, you know, forensic experts, before they become experts in forensic work, they should be experts in clinical care. So as a psychiatrist, you are literally an expert in mental illness and understanding what mental illness looks like. So something that I have written about when I write about these types of group beliefs is that one of the fundamentals of assessing somebody who you think may be speaking on the basis of a group belief is that you look for other evidence of mental illness. So individuals with schizophrenia though they may espouse delusions, they also demonstrate evidence of other symptoms. So that could be disorganized speech, grossly disorganized behavior. One of the hallmark symptoms of schizophrenia is hallucinations. So, you know, there should be, and there should also be a history of mental illness. So there may be a history of psychiatric hospitalization. So you have to take into account the person's psychiatric history. You have to take into account the presence of other symptoms of mental illness when you're making a diagnosis. Now, one of the areas where that becomes tricky when you're trying to distinguish between mental illness and, you know, participation or involvement with group beliefs would be the diagnosis of delusional disorder. So folks who have delusional disorder typically present with one or multiple delusions, and I should just define that term for listeners. A delusion is a fixed false belief that an individual will adhere to or believe even when presented with contradictory evidence. So, and typically these individuals do not have those other symptoms of schizophrenia that I described. So often they don't have hallucinations, and their behavior and thought process is not disorganized. So that can be tricky. And that is where the challenge really lies in the forensic assessment of distinguishing between what's just a delusion and what might be a conspiracy theory. So as an example of a delusion, an individual may believe that they're being persecuted by some sort of government organization, perhaps the FBI, the CIA. These are things you commonly hear. We call them persecutory delusions. So an individual may have an isolated persecutory delusion. And if the content of that delusion begins to creep into conspiracy theory beliefs, so for example, oh, there's this global cabal of pedophiles, it's the rich and famous, and they're abusing children around the country or around the world, you know, it could be hard to distinguish between, you know, somebody who's just a believer in QAnon and a person with a delusional disorder. And that's where it's important for experts to be able to distinguish between these things and to be able to dig into a person's history of involvement with the belief. And that's something I wrote about extensively in the paper I published in 2022, or 2021, excuse me, which was, how do you ask a person about their belief system, where it came from, where they first came into contact with those beliefs, and how did that involvement elaborate over time? And I think there are ways of distinguishing between delusions and, for example, a conspiracy theory.
You bring up a story that I had when I did my internship. I was sent to a psychiatric hospital, and in one occasion, I worked with, or I did an assessment on an individual that had paranoid schizophrenia. And when I got to meet him, he had a rapid speech and he was very distrustful of the staff at the psychiatric hospital. So for some reason, he trusted me. And we had this conversation and he started telling me how he believed that Mark Zuckerberg had implanted a microchip in his brain, and that if he, I forgot the specifics, but essentially he was espousing, you know, what I perceived as conspiracy theories. And when I asked him about, you know, where he got his information from, he cited InfoWars. And this was just the one interaction that I had. And I wonder, with the presence of QAnon, has that increased the number of interactions psychiatrists and mental health evaluators will have with these types of, I mean, individuals that are conspiratorial, but also have a mental disorder? You know, essentially what I'm asking is, will we see more psychiatrists faced with this new challenge of trying to differentiate between what's a mental disorder and what's a conspiracy theory? Because when I was talking to this individual, my assessment was that he truly had a mental disorder, but he just happened to also believe in a conspiracy theory.
Right. And you bring up, there are multiple points there that I want to address. The first is the idea that these things are not mutually exclusive. So individuals with mental illness, like for example, schizophrenia, may incorporate conspiracy theories into their worldview, maybe even incorporate it into their delusional belief system, right? So conspiracy theories are ripe for folks with schizophrenia. People with schizophrenia often have persecutory ideas, and conspiracy theories do as well, right? So delusions do not grow out of nowhere. I once heard a nice sort of analogy, whereas which was that like delusions are like a plant that sort of grow up against a building, like delusions come from somewhere, right? So if a person's history or past, if they're involved in a religion, they may develop religious delusions. I've worked with patients who were brilliant mathematicians, and they develop all sorts of bizarre metaphysical delusions about the nature of reality, sometimes about UFOs if they're physicists. So delusions come from somewhere. A person's not just going to begin believing something that is very strange or odd about something that they know nothing about. They have to have heard about it, or if it's an important part of their life, it may become sort of the basis of the delusions. So they grow up around the structure of the person's life. That's sort of the analogy with a plant growing up against a vine growing against a building or along a railing or something like that. You asked the question about whether or not psychiatrists are more likely to encounter individuals who are mentally ill, but also speak about conspiracy theories. That was my concern with QAnon. I work clinically in a correctional setting. I work in a county jail treating patients, and most of my time is spent working with folks with severe mental illness. So things like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and other psychotic disorders. And I have not actually seen that much incorporation of QAnon, or other types of conspiracy theories into the delusional thought content of my patients. Now, granted, I work with a very specific population. It could be that it's more common than I'm aware of, but in my clinical practice, I haven't really noticed that. But it was one of the concerns that motivated me to write about the topic, is that it's likely to come up more often, especially with people who are members of QAnon who engage in violent behavior on the basis of the conspiracy theory, which we have seen. So these individuals are likely going to, or potentially will face forensic evaluations. And so it's important that forensic evaluators understand these issues. I'm not sure if I'm missing any of the other points that you brought up.
No,
But
you answered it perfectly. I want to talk about what you wrote on your paper as delusion-like beliefs, because I think how you describe it, it's between being, I guess, normal and complete delusion. So if you can just help, the listeners understand what is DLB, delusional-like beliefs.
This is a concept that a few experts have written about, and I think it's a nice way to consider these different types of beliefs, what I call group beliefs, that are atypical. So things like conspiracy theories, things like cult beliefs. I mean, in many ways, mainstream religious beliefs are delusion-like beliefs, as well as sort of other political extremist ideologies, things like sovereign citizen belief systems. So Pierre, he's an expert who has written at length on the concept of delusion-like beliefs, and he provided a definition in a recent review that I think is both quite poetic but also useful. So he defines them as beliefs that slip through the cracks of symptom definitions and drift into the gray area between pathological and normal beliefs. So basically what he's saying is these are things that may share certain characteristics with delusions, but they're not really delusions. And the differences commonly relate to things like the prevalence of these beliefs, having a culture or a subculture that sanctions the beliefs and that sort of as a group collectively believes in these things, which brings to the fact that these are often shared beliefs. These are there might be a community that believes in this. And then there are differences in the content between delusions and delusion-like beliefs. And as I have written, there are also differences in the histories of how people develop these sorts of beliefs, where they may encounter the beliefs, and then how invested they are in the beliefs. And there are a couple different ways in which there are different models by which individuals may develop these delusion-like beliefs. One that Pierre cites that I find sort of compelling is the concept of the two deficit model of adoption of unconventional beliefs. So this is where an individual has some sort of what he calls an anomalous experience, or what I might describe as like an aha moment. And then the person interprets that aha moment inappropriately. So there's a cognitive misinterpretation of an experience, which leads you to believe something. So an example might be like a cult member who's involved in some sort of, I don't know, transcendent prayer experience, and they develop all these physical sensations, and maybe their heart starts racing. And so there's sort of an anomalous experience there. And then they interpret that as like the cult enabling them to transcend something, or like the cult like touching God or something like that, or whatever it is that they believe. So there's an anomalous experience, and then they misinterpret that experience, which leads to the formation of this unconventional belief. So yeah, that's just a little background on the concept of delusion-like beliefs. Again, I think you could classify different types of group beliefs as delusion-like. So conspiracy theories sort of fit the bill as far as delusion-like, except they are very widespread generally. Cult beliefs would be considered delusion-like, except they tend to congregate in like very small sects. That's typically what a cult is, a very small, religiously focused sect that focuses on transcendental issues. You have sovereign citizens, which is more sort of like a political extremist set of beliefs, but also shared within a community, so it's not really delusional. And like I said, I think in many ways, mainstream religious beliefs fit the bill for delusion-like, because a lot of religious beliefs are unfounded, not based on evidence. I mean, that's sort of the entire concept of faith, is putting a belief in something for which there's no real evidence. So yeah, those are some examples of delusion-like beliefs. And I think the concept is helpful.
You mentioned cults, and that reminds me of how the mainstream media, when it covers QAnon, it refers to QAnon as a cult movement. But in your literature review, you kind of challenge this label. And so my question for you is, how would you identify QAnon? Like, what is QAnon?
Yeah, I would consider QAnon to be a set of conspiracy theories. And it's an elaborate set of conspiracy theories that sort of has changed and morphed over time. In the context of different political occurrences, it changed in the context of the COVID lockdowns and became more focused on COVID. So yeah, I consider QAnon to be a set of conspiracy theories. I do not consider QAnon or its adherents to be a cult. As you mentioned, there were numerous sort of pieces that came out. People were talking about QAnon as a cult, including by some people who have sort of made their name off talking about cults and saying that they are capable of deprogramming cults. So if you have millions of people who believe QAnon, who sort of go along with the idea that QAnon's a cult, then you've got a bunch more families who can refer their family members to you to try to deprogram them. But no, QAnon's not a cult. If you look at sort of the fundamental characteristics of a cult, QAnon clearly does not really adhere to those characteristics. So a cult is typically defined by one, a consensual belief system, meaning it's a shared belief system. Typically, this belief system is it's sort of quite rigid. And so what that leads to is social cohesiveness amongst the members of the group, because everybody is sort of very tightly adherent to this belief system. And with the belief system often comes social mores. So people are expected to engage in certain behaviors, act a certain way, engage in certain rituals based on this belief system. And I should mention the belief system is typically formulated around some sort of transcendental goal. So you've got these UFO cults that think UFOs are going to come down and take them up into the heavens. Other sort of religiously oriented transcendental goals, beliefs in an afterlife, beliefs that they're doing some sort of work for a godlike figure. And that brings in sort of the last element of the cults, which is that they are typically led by what's called a charismatic leader. So there's typically like one or a few individuals who guide the behavior of the cult members. They're the ones who are elaborating the belief system and describing it. QAnon is quite different. Like QAnon came about from posts online on forum message boards where really anybody could contribute. There was sort of this shadowy character named Q who was dropping bits of information on different messaging boards, sort of elaborating the belief system of QAnon. So it sort of like loosely adheres to the idea that maybe there was a charismatic leader, but QAnon doesn't prescribe behavioral mores, really. Like individuals can choose whether, like, what parts of it to believe in. They don't have to engage in specific behaviors because they adhere to some aspects of QAnon. There's no real social cohesiveness because it's so dispersed. It's mostly an internet phenomenon, although people did sort of begin showing up at rallies with Q on their shirts and things like that. But that's not really social cohesiveness. Like nobody's prescribed to behave in a certain way or engage in certain rituals. And then the degree to which QAnon represents a consensual belief system is debatable. Again, people are allowed to pick and choose what aspects they believe in, how firmly they adhere to the beliefs, whether or not they actually engage in any behavior as a response to the conspiracy theory, or if they simply believe it and think about it every now and then as they're reading the news or whatever. So, no, I don't consider QAnon or its adherents to be a cult. Cults tend to be much smaller, much more focused, much more social cohesiveness, much more sort of behavioral demands on the individual than like a conspiracy theory would require.
Yeah, that's well put. Because I haven't looked into the QAnon phenomenon or the movement as extensively, but I have noticed that there are influential QAnon supporters that have, I guess, taken the mantle and have become QAnon leaders. And I feel like with cults, it's just one person that everyone follows. Where in QAnon, you got just influencers, right and left, and each mini community has their own version of how to interpret QAnon. So yeah, it goes back to what you were saying, that there's not that collective, agreement of what is QAnon and what they're supposed to do. It's pretty much just that the Hollywood elite are all pedophiles, but after that, it's whatever you can come up with.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to the fact that it's really an internet phenomenon, which is what enabled it to like spread across the ocean to other countries like in Europe. It's a very dispersed phenomenon. There are so many people involved that there's no way to keep track of people's behavior or what people are saying. There's no way to really know if people are just trolling or if they are actually involved in QAnon rallies. Like there's no cohesion because there's no central leader. Whereas like a cult tends to be much smaller. People are in physical proximity. I mean, if you look at the history of cults, many of them purposefully, I think, like the charismatic leader will remove the cult members away from general society and like develop a compound or have people out in the woods somewhere at a farm where they're not coming into contact with like regular folks who aren't in the cult. And that's how cult leaders are really able to maintain control. There's that physical proximity. There's that requirement for strict adherence to the rules of the cult. Which, you know, that sort of phenomenon just doesn't really exist with QAnon. Now, I mean, I suppose if there became one sort of leader who took up the mantle of QAnon and developed a very tight-knit group of followers, removed themselves out into the woods, got a compound or whatever, sure, maybe that could then sort of splinter off and become a cult. But like the belief system itself, and all of the believers dispersed across the planet, like that alone does not constitute a cult.
Yeah, it would be very difficult to create a cult, even if you meet all the requirements. I mean, controlling so many people across the world. And as you're talking about cults, the one that comes to mind is, I think it's called Jonestown, where Jim Jones like took a his like congregation to Guyana, I believe. And I mean that the history of that cult is pretty horrifying. And I just don't think that you can have that same effect with the amount of people. I mean, you carrying all those people on a plane, telling people to drink the Kool-Aid. I mean, someone's going to say something. And by someone, I mean a whole lot more people.
Yeah, I think that with cults, because there is physical proximity typically, because it tends to be a smaller group and they are both socially and physically isolated from the rest of society, that's really where the control element comes in. Like the charismatic leader has a much firmer grip on people's day-to-day lives, whereas you don't see that with conspiracy theories. Especially with something online that people are just able to read and sort of adopt beliefs as they are susceptible to them. You know, there's no sense of control there. There's nobody pulling the levers. Yeah. So they are a different phenomenon. And I have sort of voiced my opinion about that in the paper that I wrote, that I think they are a different phenomenon, but sort of related in the fact that the underlying belief system that either ties together a conspiracy theory or a cult is a delusion-like belief. So it does have those sorts of similarities, but the phenomena themselves are quite distinct.
I think that to put in simple terms, you know, conspiracy theories aren't cults, but cult leaders tend to use conspiracy theories to justify their reasoning behind why they have to be isolated. I think Jim Jones, for example, felt like the U.S. government was like after him. And I mean, I think there was a congressman that went to go visit, and when he saw that, it was like, all right, you know, this is it. This was the conspiracy theory. And so it's very interesting how, you know, conspiracy theories and cults tend to intersect I would assume a good portion of the time. You know, I only know about Jim Jones. I don't know if other cult leaders have also used conspiracy theories to justify or inform their followers.
I would be cautious in saying that. I think every case is different. I published a review on cults and whether or not individuals who committed murder on the basis of their cult beliefs were found insane for their action, like if they were found insane at the time that they committed the crime. And what I found in that review is that there were different types of beliefs in these cult systems, and I'm not sure that I would really characterize any of them as flat out conspiracy theories. Like some of the charismatic leaders that I reviewed actually seemed to be mentally ill. At least one of them was diagnosed with schizophrenia when after arrest. And so these people tend to have quite grandiose as well as persecutory beliefs. So a common statement of a a common statement of a cult leader would be that he is a messiah or some sort of godlike figure. That's not a conspiracy theory. That's simply grandiose content. And the cult leader may espouse concerns about persecution from the general society or persecution from government entities and use that as sort of a reason for the group to rally around whatever its purported goal is, or to isolate off to away from regular society, which is sort of what you saw with in the Waco, Texas incident with David Koresh sort of moving his cult to a compound. Now, in that case, the government actually was persecuting them and ended up killing a lot of them in a siege over a long period of time. So you could call it a conspiracy theory, but it was actually true in the end. And
was it did the leader say that the government was going to be was coming after them, or
yes, because I mean, that's why the government did go after them. They were stockpiling weapons at their facility. And usually when that happens in the context of a cult, it's because either they are preparing for some sort of end of days scenario or because they're preparing for some sort of standoff with the government. So yeah, in a way that that behavior is what I think provoked the government investigation and then the siege and the standoff. But yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I would call that a conspiracy theory. I think that was sort of a well-founded belief because it was actually happening because they were stockpiling weapons. So yeah, I mean, of course there's overlap in these types of beliefs. The problem is that they are typically quite persecutory. And so there's this persecutory mindset that like I'm a victim or that people are coming after me or that I know something that the rest of people don't know. And so they want to silence me. I mean, that's something that sort of a thread that runs through people with schizophrenia, people with delusional disorder, people with conspiracy theories, people who join cults. The cult often develops this sort of persecutory glow or this self-concept as a persecuted entity. So yeah, it's I think some people refer to it as like the persecuted mindset or persecutory mindset sort of runs through a lot of these different things. And so it's not surprising that there may be overlap in them. Yeah, I mean, we've seen in the past that cults have sometimes purposefully recruited mentally ill people, and it's not surprising why that might happen. Offering some sort of transcendental reward for participating in a group. Yeah, so there is overlap, but I'm not sure. This is a very long way to respond to your statement that cults commonly use conspiracy theories. I'm just not sure that that's the case.
Yeah, you know, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier, you know, like, or something I want to ask you, just like the challenge between differentiating between, you know, what's paranoia, you know, personality disorder, and what's a conspiracy theory. Because it's like, as you're telling me how cult leaders create their movements and their narratives, I'm like, that sounds like a conspiracy. Like, I see, you know, there's, you know, with the exception of Waco, well, you know, there's like there's persecution that they believe is happening, but then you're also informing me that some of these cult leaders have been found to have you know, some diagnosis. So then it's like, which one is it? And that's really the challenge for, you know, mental health evaluators. Like, you know, and it's something that our profession will probably look into in the future.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's why I'm attracted to and interested in this area, is that there is a lot of overlap. There's a lot that needs to be broken apart. If you are going to try to explain to a judge, a court, About these different types of things. You have to be educated in these different types of topics. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to explain it. You're not going to be able to help the court. And it sort of comes up. There was a review of evaluations that had been done of competency to stand trial of sovereign citizens, sort of looking at the outcomes of those. And I think the author in the piece acknowledges that, like, one of the earliest cases that he had, he opined that the person was not competent to stand trial on the basis of his beliefs. And then it was only after years of encountering these individuals that he realized that he was probably incorrect in that case, and the person was just a sovereign citizen, which is sort of both an interesting and sort of humbling acknowledgement to make in an academic paper, I think. Most people would not be so willing to admit fault or potential fault at some point in the past. But yeah, if you're not educated on these topics, if you don't know about the breadth or the different types of delusion-like beliefs, there's a risk of being wrong. And that can lead to inappropriate legal outcomes in the forensic realm and inappropriate treatment outcomes in the clinical realm. But you commented again about the challenge of distinguishing, and that's really what my paper is about, is sort of being able to distinguish these things. And I think there's a lot to be said about a few different aspects. One, an individual's mental health history. So looking back, seeing if this person has a history of psychosis in the past, seeing if they've been hospitalized in the past. A history tells you a lot about an individual. If a person has no history of psychiatric illness, psychiatric hospitalization, psychiatric treatment, and they're presenting with all of these odd beliefs, that may lead you to the second factor that I wanted to bring up, which is the idea of obtaining collateral informants. So these are individuals from the person's life, who may live with them or maybe longtime acquaintances or friends of the individual. So speaking with other people who know this person well, and they might be able to shed light on when the individual started talking about these strange beliefs that they now have. Does the person spend all day on their computer reading about things? A collateral informant can kind of elucidate that a little bit better. Like, did these beliefs come out of nowhere, in which case you might consider a mental illness? Or, as I mentioned, has the person been online? Is the person very interested in current politics, things of that nature that might lead you more to thinking that the person now adheres to a conspiracy theory. So history does tell you a lot, and collateral informants can tell you a lot as well.
If they pick up the phone, sometimes when I do collateral calls, it's hard to get to people. But yeah, what you said is perfect. I definitely agree. It helps you to distinguish between, really a diagnosis and a conspiracy theory, and the best information when patients are not compliant with the staff members to just find people that are close to them and see from their perspective, what's going on at home. Are they going to work? Or has this consumed their life to some degree? So yeah, excellent, excellent advice. Now I want to move on to probably the part that I've been excited to cover with you, and that's about whether conspiracy theories should be labeled as a mental disorder. Now, I had asked this question to Aoife Gallagher and Dr. Benjamin Dow, but they don't have a background in mental health, so they just gave me their opinion. Seeing that you have a background in mental health, I wanted to get your opinion. Now, there's been some talk about adding conspiracy theories as an addiction disorder. And when some people think about addiction disorders, they think about, like hard substances like cocaine and meth. But addictions don't necessarily need to have a substance. Currently, the DSM-5 recognizes gambling disorder as an addiction. And so when it comes to QAnon, there's been documentation of people that were normal individuals, were apolitical, were living their lives. But when QAnon came into their lives, suddenly you see a radical change. You see people declining down the rabbit hole and spending significant time, searching for few crumbs for these few encrypted messages. And you know, there's several good examples in your paper. You mentioned the incident of Egerson Madison Welch, who was the person that went to the Comet Ping Pong with the belief that there was children in the basement, and several other individuals. I don't know them by names, but people that have given up their jobs to dedicate to this movement. And when you look at this behavior, it's similar to addiction, where people are now, they spend all their times trying to obtain these drugs. And to make this short, where do you fall in this discussion, whether conspiracy theory should be included in the next revision of the DSM?
My short answer is no, it should not be. And there's a lot that I want to respond to in what you said. Where to begin? Okay. So the first issue is the use of the word addiction. Addiction really primarily refers to the use of substances to which an individual can develop a physiological dependence. So by physiological dependence, I mean that the individual develops a tolerance to the substance, meaning that they have to take more over time to get the same effect, and then a withdrawal syndrome, meaning a physiological response when the person does not get the substance. I think the word addiction gets sort of bandied about far too often to describe different types of compulsive behaviors, but they're not addictions. So the gambling disorder that you mentioned, I would categorize that more as like a compulsive behavior. The person's perhaps dopamine system, reward system has been hijacked, and so they develop a compulsion to engage in this type of behavior. Maybe they even feel a sense of tension or discomfort or depression or anxiety when they're not engaging in that behavior, but it's not really an addiction. So I just wanted to comment on the use of the word addiction. When you talk about seemingly normal people going down the rabbit hole of conspiracy theories when they came across QAnon, I would also be highly suspect of that. I would, without having evaluated somebody, I would be very hesitant to say that these folks were totally normal before they came into contact with QAnon. Not surprisingly, there are certain susceptibility criteria that have been identified for folks who, for example, join cults. So some of these might be socio-demographic factors, people who, you know, might come from low socioeconomic status. Perhaps they're sort of on the edge of society in other ways, and then they encounter a charismatic leader and they're sort of drawn to that and find some sort of salvation in that. There are also psychological factors that may predispose people. For example, people who have suffered abuse, people with certain types of dysfunctional personality traits that can make them more susceptible to joining cults. And I would suspect that a lot of folks who become sort of very down the rabbit hole and very involved in conspiracy theories also have perhaps a history of either mental health problems or dysfunctional personality traits. For example, people who are prone to sort of persecutory thinking. There's the concept of the paranoid personality disorder, which is one of our DSM diagnoses, where people sort of hold grudges. They tend to feel that the world is out against them. People with paranoid personality disorder are likely folks who might be at risk of being attracted by conspiracy theories, because the conspiracy theory sort of dovetails with their own view of themselves within the world. So until there are actual studies done on folks who sort of go down conspiracy theory rabbit holes, I would be hesitant to state that people are totally normal and then all of a sudden they read something online and they believe in QAnon, right? Like, that doesn't make sense as an explanatory model for how that happens. So that's another point that I would make. And then a third point I would make, and I encounter this in other realms of psychiatry, is the risk of pathologizing behaviors that are actually quite normal and psychopathologizing things that are quite normal. So we know from studies that conspiracy theories are extremely common. For example, just to spout off some studies that have been done like in 2014, there was a study that was done. It was an online survey, so you know there's some methodological issues with that. But the authors found that about 40% of people in the United States believe that the FDA is deliberately preventing the public from getting natural cures for cancer and other diseases because of pressures from drug companies. A whole fifth of subjects in that study said that they believed that doctors and the government were trying to vaccinate children despite knowing that vaccines cause autism. And so these things are quite common, is what I'm trying to say. And so then there's the question of like, well, where do you draw the line? Like, where do you draw the line between normal belief in conspiracy theories and pathological belief in conspiracy theories? Like, it's a relatively normal behavior that for a lot of folks serves as some sort of explanatory model for understanding the world. So when do you say it's pathological and when do you say it's not? I would be concerned that that would be sort of politically used. So like whenever somebody believes a right-wing political conspiracy theory, QAnon is often considered right-wing, that okay, those people are mentally ill. But then if people believe left-wing political conspiracy theories, well, that sort of dovetails with like what a lot of people on the left believe. So we're not going to pathologize that. So yeah, I mean, I think one, there's a general problem with pathologizing what has been found to be a relatively normal behavior in the population. And then there's a question of where do you draw the line and what do you say is pathological and is not, if you are going to label it as pathological. And I can draw an analogy to some of the work that I do evaluating sex offenders. There's a diagnosis that has been bandied about for a few decades now that attempts to pathologize the act of rape, saying that people who have committed more than one rape or multiple rapes in the past have a mental disorder, a paraphilic disorder, in that they are turned on by the act of rape, despite the fact that there's no actual way to prove that an individual is turned on by specifically raping somebody, as opposed to the fact that they're having sex with somebody, even if it is with force. And the fact that even in normal subjects, there's often arousal to sort of coercive stimuli when it's been studied in the laboratory. So again, that's an analogy just to show that like in various areas of psychiatric and forensic practice, the move to pathologize something that is either criminal, to turn a criminal behavior into a mental illness, or to turn even just a widely, broadly occurring behavior, such as belief in conspiracy theories, into a mental illness, is fraught and would have a lot of, I think, unintended consequences.
Yeah, that was very well put. I would also include that, when it comes to conspiracy theories, it's a social phenomenon. I think with diagnosis, you're really focusing on the individual, because that's really what changed it for me. Because I was in the camp that I was like, yes, certain conspiracy theories and people that believe in them should be pathologized. But then, after reading, learning about the topic of conspiracy theories, as you mentioned, you said 40. I've read somewhere that it was like 72% of Americans believe in a conspiracy theory. That's still a massive amount of people. But yeah, the rape example that you gave is a good one, because if people commit crimes and you can, excuse it with a conspiracy theory diagnosis, then almost everyone in January 6th that went to Capitol Hill is going to use that to escape, whatever current punishment. And that's really the ethical dilemma that we face.
Right. And that's where my statement that creating mental diagnoses as a way of pathologizing social phenomena has many unintended consequences. So, as an example, with this rape paraphilia that I described, when that was first proposed in like the 70s and 80s, there was massive pushback against it by like feminist groups and other groups saying, well, if you pathologize rape this way, then rapists are just going to say they're mentally ill as a way of avoiding criminal responsibility. But now, fast forward a few decades, now this same diagnosis is being used to label rapists as mentally ill after they've completed their prison term in order to send them to psychiatric hospitals indefinitely. So this is an area where I do a lot of evaluations. But yeah, a similar thing could be, as you noted, potentially applied to conspiracy theorists who commit crimes. Now, one of the weaknesses, I would think, or I would say, of criminal responsibility evaluations is that you are often asked to give an opinion if the person meets the criteria for insanity in that particular jurisdiction or wherever they committed their crime. The sanity statutes differ by state. So, what counts as insane in one area, one jurisdiction, may not count as insane in another jurisdiction. So, keeping that in mind, yeah, I think you're often coming down to a binary decision. So, like, you're making a diagnosis and then you're assessing whether or not the person's behavior and their mental state at the time means that they were insane at that time or not. There's less wiggle room potentially to really explain something. So, like, I don't believe that having a conspiracy theory makes you mentally ill. So, if I were evaluating somebody who really they engaged in their behavior exclusively because of their belief in the conspiracy theory, I would not be able to opine that that person was insane. However, it would be useful for the court potentially to sort of understand how what the person thinks, to understand how they developed that belief, and to understand how that belief influenced them at the time that they committed the crime. Now, whether or not the legal decision maker, whether it's a judge or jury, finds that persuasive or in any way relevant in sentencing the person, that sort of would be out of my hands. But yeah, I think it's important, regardless of whether or not the person meets the criteria for insanity in a particular case, is to really help explain the behavior as it relates to the person's belief system and to share the history of that belief system and whether or not the person was influenced by that belief system. Now, oftentimes the purpose of a finding of insanity is because after the person is found insane, they will typically be sent to a forensic hospital where they receive treatment, ongoing evaluation of their mental disorder and their risk for violence. And then typically, once the person is found to no longer be a significant risk for violence, and they're receiving adequate treatment, they get released into the community. It's unclear what benefit there would be to sending somebody with conspiracy theories to a state hospital for treatment. It's unclear what the treatment would really even be. But yeah, it's interesting. And yeah, we don't have good treatment models for these sorts of things. Again, I don't even really consider it a mental illness. So whether or not a treatment would be indicated is another question. Perhaps the court would establish other sort of restrictions on an individual if they were, for example, released on probation, like they're not allowed to access these sort of QAnon message boards. Their online activity could be monitored, things like that, which the court will impose those sorts of restrictions at times if they feel it's indicated. Just take as an example the sex offender legislation restricts people pretty significantly in what they're able to do if they're released on probation, so or parole. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's a complicated one, and I mean, when it comes to just treating, hypothetically, in this situation, someone with like extreme conspiratorial beliefs, like how do you work with an individual like that? When I've worked with people with paranoid schizophrenia, they don't trust us. They don't trust me. The one example that I gave you previously, I was the only one that he trusted until I showed a sign of doubt, and as soon as I showed it, he cut me off, and I couldn't work with him effectively. So I can only imagine people that are distrustful of, the medical institutions and government. But, Dr. Holota, I want to thank you so much for your time. This was a great conversation. I learned a lot by speaking with you. And so, before we end, do you have any social media that people can follow you?
I do not have social media, no. If anybody wishes to contact me, I do have a website that they can reach out through the website. It's just Brian Haloida at excuse me, brianhaloida.com. Actually, let me verify that before I give that out. I think that's still it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just BRIANHOLOYDA.com. So there are ways of getting in touch with me through that website if somebody's interested.
Well, Dr. Holoya, thank you so much for your time. It was a pleasure speaking with you. It was a pleasure reading your literature review. And as I tell everyone that I speak to, thank you for your contribution in this area of conspiracy theories and disinformation.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Hi there. I hope you enjoyed today's interview with Dr. Brian Holoida. If you're interested in contacting him or reading his literature review on QAnon, you can find the links on the show notes below. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, be sure to leave me a 5-star review. By doing so, you help expose this podcast to people who might be interested in conspiracy theories within politics. If you're listening on any other platform, be sure to subscribe to get more analysis on the conspiratorial mindset. You can follow me on Facebook, Instagram, Thread, and on Twitter at The Social Chemist. Be sure to share this episode with your friends to have some interesting discussions about today's episode. So with that being said, take care, be safe, and question everything with logic. Thank you.